Welcome to Lost Cast. We've been away for a while.
We've been away for about 3 weeks, 4 weeks, and several weeks before that, 6 weeks since a new episode had aired, and this week we had a good one.
Yeah, we did our holiday podcast a few weeks ago, but we're back now.
That's right.
So, Brian, do you want to talk a little bit about what we're going to address?
Cool. We're gonna go over some general reactions, some user comments. We're going to get into Echo's backstory, some sort of parallels between Charlie and Echo with his heroin habit. Of course, we'll be all over the old Smokey, the monster, and all the different theories and conversations going on about that. We'll have a little bit on Michael's computer conversation. Not a whole lot of new stuff to go on, but definitely one little element that's kind of cool. We've got an in-depth mural analysis that a Lost fan out there has sort of posted that has some sort of new development, some interesting aspects that have gone sort of overlooked regarding the mural in the hatch in the Swan Station. We don't have a spoiler cast from Brian McMillan this week, but we do have some spoilers of our own. And then we'll do a little next time on Lost discussion based on some of the information we have from the previews and from other sources as well.
So we're going to start right off with the general reactions to the episode. And as always, you know, we kind of go out there and look at some of the forums. They have their polls that they ask their users, you know, what did you think about this episode? And just one of the forums, we looked at the lost-forum.com poll, and it was pretty highly rated. About 12% of people said it was the best episode of Lost ever. 40% said it was awesome. 30% loved it. So overall, the majority of people, yeah, almost all of them, thought it was a great episode.
For our next podcast, we should go back and look back on the season and try to see which one was the highest rated.
You know, because part of me also says, I mean, I thought it was a good episode,
yeah,
but the best episode of Lost ever?
Yeah, no way.
I don't think so. People were happy, I think, to get a new episode.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I mean, people throw that best episode ever thing around pretty loosely.
Now, one of the things that's interesting, just to address, it kind of backs it up a little bit, is some people were posting out there about the ratings that they actually got for the show, and Nielsen Net Rating said it was about 20.5 million viewers. So kind of the article associated with it was, you know, Lost is still going strong. So they're still definitely picking up new users and new people that are watching and
new users, new audience members. They're using the television, yeah, show for their entertainment, so you're kind of right.
So we're going to start off with some user comments, and we've got a couple of them. Matt sent us an email. This is about some technical issues maybe around the show. He says, please stop screaming slash singing during the episode, or at least adjust the volume a bit. Last week's episode nearly blew my eardrums out while listening on my iPod, and that was after the four-minute message from the listener that was so faint I could not make out a single word. So we have a pretty basic mic setup.
We got one microphone. It's supposed to be omnidirectional, but it's really unidirectional.
Yeah, so there may be, there from time to time, some volume issues. And as far as the actual audio comments that we get, because they're recorded through a voicemail, if someone's kind of talking a little bit lightly when they send us one of those messages, we really have a hard time being able to, yeah, really pump up the volume.
And so, the singing, I had a tendency to break out into saying Zanzibar in song whenever that word would come up, and that's because of Tenacious D. I mean, if you haven't gone back and if you haven't listened to Tenacious D, that's where I got the whole Zanzibar thing from.
I can't believe I just used the phrase pump up the volume.
Yeah, dude.
Yeah, you did.
That's bad.
Yeah. You love Christian Slater.
So,
There was another comment. Somebody had posted that they were wondering, what's the clicking? What's up with the clicking? And I had made a joke that Robert is actually sensitive about his nervous tick. But no, Robert doesn't have a tick. I have no idea where the clicking is coming from. Robert has a tendency to surf and research stuff while we're while we're doing the podcast, but also sometimes we bump the table and the microphone wobbles, and that might make a clicking sound.
Yeah, we have multiple laptops in here, so sometimes we're clicking around.
Yeah. I think maybe John turns on the click effect when he's putting the audio together.
Yeah, that's really something that we've added to enhance the podcast.
That's high quality stuff, the clicking.
So we got another email from a guy named Hutch who's in the UK, and this is something he wanted us to kind of help him out. He says that I wondered if you could help me out. I downloaded the episodes of Series 2 week by week from various P2P programs, stuff like, you know, whatever, LimeWire, things like
that. Yeah, we don't recommend stealing the show.
He says, because obviously the UK hasn't gotten to season two yet. He says, but every week it gets harder for me to download the next episode. I've looked into paying for it on iTunes, but I can't because I'm not a U.S. resident. And if anybody doesn't know, if you're in iTunes, you assign yourself a country when you set up an account. And if I'm a U.S. iTunes user, I can't buy things from the iTunes UK store. I don't know why they separate it out like that. So he says he wonders if there's any possibility that we could find any fellow Lost Buddies, listeners of this podcast that are U.S. residents, who could either sign up for the iTunes U.S. site and give him the login details and bill him via PayPal or something like that, and he'll pay for the show. If anybody's into something like that, I think the other thing we suggested to him that, you know, he check out BitTorrent or some of the other places that people download stuff from. Obviously, you're downloading it illegally, but, I mean, the flip side is, look, this guy's in the UK. He wants to pay for the episodes, but he has no way to do it.
He has no way to do it.
So
they got to get on the ball.
So if anybody wants to help out, you can either post a comment to our site or send us an email. We'll get to him.
Now, does UK have video available? I mean, they do. They just don't have Lost. And I imagine it's because Lost doesn't want to put the episodes over there before they've aired on the on TV.
Yeah, I'm not sure. They probably don't want to do that because of where the season's at. But
I've got a couple forum comments about, as we're talking about general reactions to this episode. Hoggle says he thinks they probably lost a good chunk of their viewers tonight. He was watching with folks who have been fans up till now, but after that scene with the monster, they're no longer interested. A while ago, they claimed that the show could be explained, the producers claimed the show could be, all the stuff could be explained scientifically or whatever it was, but that really can't. I don't know. It may still be able to be explained scientifically. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. This Hoggle, he personally, he's still into it, but that scene was the scene with the smoke was a big enough blow to turn away anyone who was on the fence. My sister, who I got hooked a few months ago, called right at the commercial break, and her exact words were, "I thought you said this was not a sci-fi show. WTF was that supposed to be?" Which is probably a sentiment being shared by a lot of people right now. Sue, another Fuselage member, says, "Here we go. Minutes after another great week of Lost, someone runs to the Fuselage to say that the show has really done it and will lost viewers. Funny how people just keep on watching." And then Jen says, "Yeah, I think they were straddling the is it sci-fi or not line for a while, and now they finally bridged it. They may lose some viewers to this, but it will make some more fans out of idle viewers. I think it was brave of them to finally get off the fence, although personally I think it's been leaning this way for a while." I don't know if it's brave, but I mean, initially I saw or heard an interview on The Treatment, which is a show you can download from KCRW.com. It's a Santa Monica NPR sort of station. That's just, in my opinion, one of
the
best.
They have a podcast.
They've got a podcast, and it's one of the best, best radio stations in America. And, they archive all of their past shows. And anyway, there was one show, The Treatment, where they interviewed J.J. Abrams, and he talked about how Lost was him selling a sci-fi show as a character drama.
Yeah,
and so
I always thought that the premise of it, I mean, at the outset, was that it was a sci-fi show.
Yeah.
So,
and I don't think he told the people that were going to sign off on the show that. They came to him and said, "We just want a show about people on an island. We want a drama to compete with Survivor. That's not a reality show." And they felt the only way they could do it and have it be cool was to reach back in their with their great passion and love for the Twilight Zones and all the other sort of old sci-fi stuff. And so it's a sci-fi show. But with that said, my wife and I thought The Smoke was really pretty corny as far as special effects go. I mean, I wasn't a big fan of how they pulled it off.
I think the beginning of it, I think the end of it kind of looked cheesy to me.
The overhead shot where you're looking down at it, I just thought it was kind of corny.
You know, the way it went away, I don't know.
I mean, I think that, you know, we can, obviously, we have our own, like, you know, personal opinions about the episode and about the monster and all that stuff. But, I mean, overall, the general reaction to the episode was that it was a great episode. I have seen several kind of comments here and there where people say, "It was cheesy, I'm done with this," you know, yada, yada. We get those almost every time. But again, the thing that in the official Lost podcast from the show with Carlton Cuse and Damon Lindelof, they said in this last Monday, right before the show aired, they said that some more details were going to air about the monster. And what they said was basically some people's kind of views about it are going to be confirmed and other people's are going to be denied. So I think a lot of the people maybe were hoping for the monster to be something different or something like that.
I just didn't expect this the inky smoke to look like something from the special effects crew who worked on Xena. Basically.
Well, and I liked
harsh,
it.
But
yeah, it was bad. It was actually bad special effects.
I don't think so. I liked it. Yeah. So.
Well, you're easy to please.
So one of the other user comments that we have, this is actually an audio comment, and I wanted to play a short section of it because it's kind of it's actually a guy who had gone back and listened to our holiday special where we were talking about some theories, and he had an audio comment and he said, "Hey, you know, I obviously was too late to submit something to that, but I wanted to bring up another theory, and it's something that I had heard a couple mentions of, but I think it's something interesting to consider, so we're going to play that here.
Hi, guys. This is Jeffrey from Maryland. First off, I'd like to say love the podcast. And this might be a little late, but I have a theory that I got from a woman named Sandy in Ohio from the Transmission podcast when I was listening to it. Okay, here's the theory. The island is invisible. It's like the glass dome over the computer in the orientation film. Plane crash because the Dharma Institute opened a dome or electromagnetic time tunnel. The plane went into the past, not the future. It went back roughly 20 years or so. Evidence to comply with this is the reason why Locke can walk, why the computer in the hatch is so outdated, according to Locke, 20 years. The orientation film itself with the projector, those aren't around anymore. The Apollo candy bars, again, not around anymore. The U.S. Army knife that Goodwin had was 20 years old. And the main reason why no one is looking for the survivors.
I don't know if the computer being old is evidence that they went back 20 years.
It's in line with it.
It fits with everything else. It's just as good as any other theory.
It does. But, I mean, if they did go back 20 years, then the equipment would be brand new, I imagine, and then that film would have just been made, roughly. But 20 years from when? Because we don't know when they went back.
Yeah, we don't know. We don't know how long all that stuff has been there on the island. But I thought it was interesting, particularly that it made the connection, you know, that this is why Locke can walk, because 20 years ago he could walk.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems to fit. Obviously, I think there may be a couple things that kind of throw that off, but I think it's an interesting theory, at least.
Yeah. I think Danielle's transmission being 16 years old and her aging, I imagine, to some degree, because she knows she's been there for a long time, so I don't know. Maybe that just kind of throws it out for me.
It's interesting. So that's all of our user comments. We're going to dig now, and Brian's going to talk a little bit about Echo's backstory.
Now, I think that probably one of my favorite backstories so far, and a lot of that has to do with, you know, how contemporary the sort of warlordism in Africa is these days, and how intense a drama that really is. They couldn't probably go into the detail to really portray warlordism accurately, because it wouldn't be fit for television. To give you guys a sense, for those of you that aren't aware of the stuff that happens in Darfur and Liberia and other places in Africa, what happens is they're in these wars where you have these sort of rebel gangs running around, commandeering children, taking them into their sort of war tribes or bandit groups, if you will, that are 8, 9 years old. They're feeding them all kinds of speed and other sorts of drugs. They're putting guns in their hands, and they're encouraging sort of, headhunter, cannibalistic, old world tribal sort of soul, you know, ways to like capture your enemy's soul. So there's a lot of dismemberment of victims and just really barbaric and intensely violent stuff going on. And so to know that Echo just comes from that tells me that his past is most likely a lot more violent and a lot more, controversial than we're led to see just in this little bit. Yeah, he cuts two guys' throat with the sort of like, you know, action hero move, which is what that was. And he's running guns and all that sort of stuff. But all the other sort of signs of him being taken as a kid and the kids being asked to shoot the old man in the village and stuff, all that stuff lines it up with what's happening today over there in Africa.
You really couldn't pick. I mean, I think the kind of overall idea is if you were going to give a character a bad past, this is like one of the worst you could possibly give them.
And we almost called it. We actually, a long time ago in one of our past, we said that, do you have something pulled up from it?
Yeah, Matt, who posted on October 20th, said, I think we're going to find out that Mr. Echo is a vet of one of Africa's many civil wars. Could explain why he knows his way around the jungle so well and is handy in a fight. I also heard it mentioned that he had a haunting backstory, so he probably read some of the spoilers. but his theory was he thought he was actually one of the survivors from the drug plane, so he figured he was connected somehow. But his assumption was he was connected with the drug plane, as in he had crashed with it when he first saw him. So
that's what,
close enough.
Where Matt kind of goes off is he says based on the way Echo was taking orders from Anna Lucia, it led Matt to think way back then that he might have been, you know, a reluctant muscle to a warlord or a field commander of some Central African strongman. In fact, he was the strongman. I mean, he was a sort of a leader of that group.
I thought it was interesting because I think there was a pretty logical connection when we found out that the plane was originated from somewhere in Africa. When we obviously have the one character from Africa show up on the show, we think, I bet there's a connection between the two. But I thought it was great, you know, the actual connection, the way they set it up, the whole storyline with him and his brother, all that stuff, which was something that I think was something we couldn't kind of foresee.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I thought it was great. And I agree. It's one of my favorite, I think, backstories I've seen so far.
Yeah, so far. It was really well done, but you touched on a good point where you're about the plane. How did that small of a plane make it to that island? A plane leaving from Nigeria ended up in the South Pacific.
And it may not be like that important, but a lot of people have brought this up. I saw some talk on one of the forums, and I can't remember exactly which one it was, but somebody was saying that that type of plane that they used was obviously it was an older plane. They also said that it was an unpressurized cabin plane. So it's a plane that can't fly too high. Obviously, planes that are built to go much longer distances can fly a lot higher than that one could. So the assumption is that they would have had to stop somewhere between Africa and getting to the island because the plane just doesn't have the range to make it there. And I think that maybe, who knows, we may see in another episode, because again, we still haven't seen the full Echo backstory. We haven't seen why he was in Australia.
Right.
The idea might be that he knew where the plane was going and was going to rendezvous with them. Maybe the plane stopped in Australia.
But, I mean, our flight was from Australia to L.A. It wasn't going from back to Nigeria.
Yeah.
So the direction to me is just a little bit weird. Unless, as the documents on the Hanso site has just suggested, something weird is going on the coast of Africa.
So maybe there's
So maybe it's closer to Africa than we all think.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why Echo was on the plane or something. He had gone to...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's some really good backstory yet to be revealed for Echo in terms of how he got on the plane. Was he that bad guy all the way up till when he crashed? Or had he made his transformation all the way back when his brother sort of sacrificed himself?
And I think it seems to kind of it kind of points to him accepting this kind of role as a priest, but we don't know if he's still kind of continued with his ways or not. So.
I don't know. The amount of knowledge that guy has and how he's just able to cite verse and cite all these stories, it kind of leads you to believe that he's got some formal education and formal training. He had to invest a lot of time.
He was probably like 10 years old. Do you think when he protected his brother by shooting the guy for him and took him by the warlord?
Pretty young, maybe early teens.
And he was raised in a church, so I'm sure he's got all kinds of education. That's but I think that sort of speculation and the speculate, you know, looking at what kind of plane it was and could have gotten that far. I think those are things that we just can't. We can't dig too deep into. They just found a plane in Hawaii and they said, "Ah, that'll be good. We'll use that one," and we'll figure this stuff out later.
Yeah, so I think that there are obviously some more questions with that, but overall I think good backstory.
Yeah.
So one of the things we're going to move into, I'm going to talk a little bit about Charlie's heroin habit and this whole thing. And I think that, obviously one of the interesting things was that, you know, a lot of people seem to be really down on Charlie in this episode. And one of the things that I was thinking about as I was watching it was, okay, yes, Charlie has this stockpiled statue or whatever. But I think that the general idea that they were getting across was that he was not currently using, but he still had this stuff with him. but everybody was treating him like he was still using.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, I was telling Brian earlier, I said one of the funniest posts that I saw in the fuselage was someone had a post that said, anyone else think Claire should die? And they were like, I can't believe, you know, how badly Claire is treating Charlie, you know, after all he's done for her and all this stuff.
Well, he kind of deserves it. I mean, if you look how it's set up.
He's got heroin, and she's got, like, how old is her baby? You don't want a heroin addict around your baby.
But that's the point of it.
Might be a little sensitive right now about what you want around my baby, but.
The thing I thought was interesting, though, was that no one seems to be really helping him. You know, it's like he's got, and he's not using. He just has the heroin stockpiled.
But only Claire and Echo know at this point. Who else knows it?
Locke saw it as well.
Locke knows as well.
Oh, that's right from earlier on.
And Locke was the only one who's actually tried to sort of help him, but in a weird kind of Locke way.
I don't know. Out on the beach, he looked pretty jacked up.
But I think
the Kings asking Jen, you know, Kate with K.
The thing I kept thinking about was here's this guy who is definitely on the fence. Like he may not be using right now, but we know he's got all these drugs, and he's on this fence. And you know, all these other people on the island are willing to help everybody out and all this stuff, but he's like getting just stonewalled by everybody.
I don't know if he's getting stonewalled. I think he keeps his problems so much so to himself that no one's aware that he needs help. But I look at how frustrated over the last couple episodes Claire gets so frustrated because Charlie's always trying to tell her how to do things and getting on her case all the time, and that she's wound up ready to lash back at him for something. And so when she finds out that he's toting around heroin and all that sort of stuff, it's like oh, you've been telling me all this stuff to do when you're a heroin addict. And then also it's something else that's worth noting, you know, it was kind of weird they show that scene at the end, like a squirrel with his nut sticking his Virgin Mary statues down in that hole, that he knew where the plane was.
Yeah.
He knew. I mean, he knew where and how he just kept that sort of aloofness and that sort of lie going so strongly throughout. He's such a good deceiver.
He's a heroin addict. I mean, he's addicted to heroin. I mean, come on. This is pretty serious drug addiction. You'll do all types of crazy stuff. I think the one thing that kind of the thing that he said in the episode was he said to Claire, you know, he admitted that he lied, but he said it makes me feel safer knowing that I have it.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's typical any type of behavior that anybody would go through if they had a drug addiction like that. So,
well, do you think that – did Echo tell him to go up in the tree before he saw the smoke going by?
Yeah.
So he saw
no, –
he told
no,
him
– No. He saw the smoke going by first.
And then he told him to get up
then
in the tree?
Then
Charlie didn't know, earlier. But
– Yeah, Charlie didn't know, but Echo had saw the smoke.
Earlier.
And this earlier, though.
So did Echo really send Charlie up in the tree to figure out where they were, or did he send him up in the tree to clear out while this smoke thing was going to come around?
I think at that moment in time, he didn't know where he was, get up in the tree and figure it out.
Okay.
And it just so happened that he was safe.
Yeah.
But I think one of the interesting things, and I think that, you know, the whole Charlie heroin addiction storyline, I don't think really does much for the show. I mean, it sets up maybe some character conflict and drama and stuff like that.
Dude, drug lines are the most tired plot lines out there. I'm tired of drug plot lines.
But one of the things that I thought was interesting, we got an email from a guy named Tim Humphrey. I know he sent us some stuff before, and he brings up some interesting parallels between Echo and Charlie. And it was something that I hadn't really thought about as I was watching it. But when he sent me this email, I started to think about some of these a little bit more. But he says, both Echo and Charlie did something in order to save their brother. And I don't know necessarily that Charlie did anything to save his brother, but he talks a lot about his relationship with his brother and his brother kind of getting him involved in all this stuff. And, you know, then his brother turning out to be the one who's, like, cleaned up his life, and he's the one who's all messed up. He says... this choice to save their brother would eventually lead them down a road they originally would not have chosen. Both the roads involved heroin, but that wasn't one of the important parallels. He says, in each case, the brother they tried to save wound up better than Echo and Charlie in a way their brothers ended up trying to save them. Now these two meet up on the island and struggle with their past. The main difference between their struggles was the path they decided to take on the island. In Echo's story, after the encounter with the monster, he decides to get back on the path of righteousness. Or he made some decision at some point in his life to get back on the path of righteousness. On the other hand, Charlie continues to struggle with giving up heroin, staying on the path that he's been. So in some ways, their stories are another light, dark side type thing. And, you know, there are a couple other things, too. I think the heroin connection is there. The brother connection is there. There's also, I think, a Catholic connection. They were both had that in common. So I think it was interesting where, you know, I kind of thought that it was just like Charlie's just thrown in there so Echo can find the plane.
Yeah.
But I think there may be something a little bit more to the kind of similarities between their situations.
And it's funny. I was telling Robert, I guess on Thursday, that if Charlie knew what Echo's backstory was, he wouldn't have been such a annoying little brat the whole way going out there, because Echo would put someone like that down in a second just to stop him from talking.
You'd beat him with the Jesus stick.
Yeah.
That was the best line of the Jesus stick.
One of the other things that was brought up, and this is kind of something that people found after the fact, is I guess when Charlie and Jen are fishing, and Charlie's asking him, hey, do you know who the Kinks are? And he's like singing this Kinks song. Well, somebody on the forums found out that this is actually the Kinks song that he was singing. They identified which one it is.
He's Evil.
It's called He's Evil, and it's pretty interesting. And we got the lyrics here, so, Brian, no singing.
No, I don't know if we should read it or we should just post it. I think maybe I'll read the first
bit. We can post it. We'll read a little bit of it.
Okay, it's the Kinks, He's Evil. He comes on smooth, cool, and kind, but he wants your body, not your mind. He's got style, personality, but he's the devil in reality. He'll make you laugh, he'll make you smile, and make you feel good for a while. Wicked smile, decadent grin. He likes schoolgirls, nuns, and virgins, which is, you know, whatever. He's got wit, he's got charm. This is the second verse. But when he gets rough, he'll break your arm. He's got taste, manners, and grace. But when he gets tough, he'll slit your face. He'll buy you jewels, expensive clothes, and his mind will go, and he'll bust your nose. He's a joker and a clown, but he'll pervert you and drag you down. And so it's look out, he's evil, is a little verse.
It seems to have a lot, I think, to do with heroin. Like, yeah. It seemed like it was pretty direct correlation.
That's probably pretty right, yeah.
They actually talked again on the official Lost podcast this last week. They talked about, someone asked them a question about the significance of the music.
Yeah.
And they were saying, yeah, that, you know, they make really deliberate choices in all the music that they put in, so.
And who is this, the director of, he's done all those heroin movies. Has been slated as one of the guest directors.
Oh, really?
What is his name?
The guy who did Requiem for a Dream,
yes,
and all that?
Yes.
I can't remember the name.
The guy who did Requiem for a Dream, which is a really, really hardcore story about people lost in various sort of drug addictions. He's slated to direct one of the final episodes. And, man,
that might be a Charlie-centric episode.
Yeah, are they going to get him in here? Man, you do heroin like nobody else. Let's get you in here and direct this heroin story.
Well,
he's got the heroin niche down.
He's got the heroin director's niche down.
Well, we're going to move into the discussions about the monster, and Brian's going to kick this off. There's a lot to talk about.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot to talk about, but at the same time, there's just like people are laying out all these different variables.
Let's talk about one of the things first. I think a lot of those people that I saw that were posting that, hey, this monster's cheesy, I'm done with it, didn't see the images in the monster. So that's the first thing that we should bring up.
Yeah.
If you don't know, I'm sure everybody's probably aware by now, but there were a number of images inside of the monster that were being shown
basically shots from the backstory, Echo's backstory that we saw through the episode.
Yeah.
So you see, you know, you're watching Echo's backstory, and then all those images in the smoke were all scenes from that backstory. And so basically, what is it? People are saying nanobots, alien technology, smart dust, which we'll talk about a little bit later, a new kind of electromagnetic being, a machine of some sort that is cloaked in the smoke, or the smoke is its exhaust, or it's the thing that causes the sickness the French Lady Rousseau mentioned in the first season. The smoke is a scout for the monster and not actually the monster. There are several different monsters, and this is just one of them. And then, you know, think back to Locke's experience with the monster. The first time he saw it, he stopped and stared at it, and it left him alone. The second time, it tried to pull him into the hole. And so you look at that and wonder, is it the same monster? What changed between his first interaction with it and the second? And then you've got the idea of what was it doing? It was either, what was it doing by looking at Echo and presenting all these images? We don't know if Echo could see those images or not, I guess, by the way. But what was it doing? It was either scanning Echo, pulling out his history, or it already had his information and it was showing him his history. And whether or not it causes harm, does it depend on whether the subject is afraid or not? If it's afraid, then it takes them. If it's not afraid, it doesn't take them.
Or if it scans the memory and it sees that they're good or bad.
And then that's the other one. Is the subject good or evil? And so the truth may be somewhere amongst all those different variables. M. Ferris says, we already know that there's an underground component to Smokey. As everyone's calling the smoke monster Old Smokey. Remember, he tried to pull Locke down. Maybe there's an underground vents or something, or maybe Smokey is organically created by the island itself, and the island is a living thing. And M. Ferris says, what drives me nuts is why the Lostaways go back. Why they don't go back out and check those holes later. I guess they don't want to get grabbed, but you think they'd want to know. And I was telling John that earlier. It's like, why don't they go back and just look over this, where those trees were taken up or where those holes are made? And Existential Angel from the fuselage says, watching in slow motion, she could see the monster go through the last tree. It enters the center, the smoke enters the center, and you could see what looks like woven tree fibers that fly apart when the monster emerges on the other side. It seems that it's exploding the trees from the inside a couple of feet up from the ground. It's actually pretty cool, she says, watching that effect. But if we're to believe the monster's perspective, then it's not TNT. And that's part of this whole discussion going online that somehow the others or somebody planted TNT in all these different trees, and they're like tripwires blowing up the trees as they come around. And I think that that interesting idea is that you've got the exploding trees, and then you've got the smoke, and they do seem to be two different components of the same thing.
Yeah, and there, I think that one of the things that people have been talking a little bit about is the whole, are there multiple monsters, or which monsters are which, you know, that type of thing.
So stepping back, we're doing the what is it, and we'll talk about what you're on right now is talk about what the monster is.
Yeah, so one of the things that I saw brought up several times was people referencing different interactions that people have had with the monster as the same as this one we were shown with Echo. And we know, I think, that you know, we were shown the episode where Locke does get dragged down. There is a kind of a scene there where Echo is looking at that smoke cloud. We don't see, though, what it is that he sees in it. Mm-hmm. And one of the great comments that we got was actually an email that we got from a person named McKelly Scholler, who sent us a comment and said, when Terry O'Quinn was coached on that scene, on the scene in season one,
where Locke confronted the monster, only we didn't see the smoke.
Where
we
he sees
like
it
the
face
monster
to face.
Perspective, where the camera's looking right at him.
So he said, when Terry O'Quinn was coached for that scene, he was told to think of the most beautiful thing ever. And they said, you know, was it Helen? Was it Walt's apparitions to Shannon were also manifestations? Did that maybe have something to do with it? He said, side leaves, and 5 seconds later, there's Walt. And this gets back to this whole idea that a lot of people have been bringing up, which is the parallel to Michael Crichton's Prey, the novel where there's like this nano swarm that can manifest itself as anything.
Yeah, and nanobots, for those of you that aren't aware, are basically molecular-sized machines that billions of them get together and work together to do unusual things. They could take the shape of anything, and they basically look like a cloud of particles, but they could take the shape of a human or a machine or whatever.
So that's what brings up this whole idea that, you know, McKelly's talking about, where, you know, we don't see what Locke sees, mm-hmm. But, you know, we're assuming that he sees something similar to what Echo saw, whether it's from his own life or whatever. And that's why I think prompted the whole comment about Helen, mm-hmm. you know, could he see things from his past and stuff like that. But we'll get into a little bit more. I know we've got a little bit more on this kind of idea of nanobots. And do we actually want to talk about smart dust?
Let's talk about smart dust. We're in the what is it deal. And I think this is interesting. Smart dust is something that's listed in Wikipedia. It's similar to nanobots, but a little different.
Well, we got an email from Raj that was about that. And he was just like an email where he just said, I've got one word, smart dust. And so we pulled from Wikipedia, and we'll put a link to this on the site, but from Wikipedia, they basically say, the smart dust is a hypothetical network of tiny wireless micro-electromechanical sensors, or robots, or devices installed with wireless communications that can detect anything from light to temperature to vibrations.
Now, I wish everyone could see all the hand gestures that John's
making
right now.
I have this thing where I wiggle my fingers, and that means wireless communication.
Almost jazz hands.
Almost. He's got jazz hands.
So just to give you an idea, they have an interesting thing in here that's about applications. And again, I would say that as far as Wikipedia says, this is a hypothetical thing. It's not something that actually exists. But they say a typical application scenario would be something like scattering hundreds of these sensors, thousands, millions of these sensors around a building or a hospital to monitor temperature or humidity or inform of disasters like earthquakes. In the military, they could be used as a remote sensor to track enemy movements, detect poisonous gas or radioactivity. things like that. So I think that this is, it's kind of an extension of the whole nanobot swarm thing.
It's a nice,
sophisticated as nanobot.
Yeah. It's a nice loophole because it also doesn't sound as menacing as nanobots, but it's a nice loophole because the producers can say, oh, it's not nanobots.
Well, yeah. You know, and that's the thing. I think once I saw those images in there, I think before when I saw it, I was like, oh, yeah, smart dust, that makes sense. Nanobots, that's cool. But when I saw the images in there, I was like, wait a second. Because having those images from their past lives in there brings, I think, a really supernatural element to that monster. And
psychic smart dust.
It's got to be something, you know, more than that. Because even if that monster already had these things inside of it, I don't remember there, like, being a camera there when, you know, he got shot, you know, when he shot that dude. So how could it have all these images? It has to be something either pointed out of
it's either
something being reflected from the person.
Yeah.
So Echo was thinking about it at that moment. He was about to get the plane, so all those memories are conjured up. The nanobot, old Smokey, Lozilla, whatever you want to call it, pulls it out of him and spits it back out and regurgitates it to him.
It's one or two. Either it already knows and it's showing it to him.
No.
Or else it's pulling it out from him and showing it.
Now, I would also say that my kind of personal opinion is that I think that the monster that killed the pilot is a different one than Smokey. I think they're two different monsters.
I think it depends on how the person reacts to it. Locke was ready to embrace it. Echo embraced it. Pilot did not embrace it.
Now, the only thing that brings a kink in that, though, is that we know that the smoke monster thing doesn't make that loud, like, train whistle noise, which is the one that killed the pilot makes that noise.
Well, that noise was also
associated with it.
But that howling noise, which sounds like, you know, a mechanical sound or some sort of high-pitched sound coming out of a long tunnel, because the way it echoes, the way it reverberates, that was made when Locke was dragged into the hole. And that noise was being made while it was pulling him into the hole. And then Kate threw the dynamite in. It blew up. And out of the hole came the smoke.
Now, there was a distinct, though, when that whole scene happened, there was a distinct, I thought, difference between those two things that were happening. And that's where all the people started talking about the security system after that episode. Because you have the whole howling, whistling thing happening. And then you have this smoke thing dragging Locke down. And he's saying, I'll be okay. And that's when people started to go, okay, maybe that the smoke thing is a security system that's protecting against that other thing, trying to protect Locke against the other monster.
Yeah. So, and then there's, I guess, going back to here's something interesting. Ramsey the Ninth, who's a pretty high-level poster on the fuselage, he refers to the smoke, and one little thread, he refers to the smoke as kind of being smoke and mirrors controlled by some mastermind behind the island, so that there is a sort of intelligence behind it, people that are using the smoke to sort of see what's going on and detect what's going on. And then Amy 8376 did something funny, I think, that I hadn't thought of. It takes a literal relationship between the phrase smoke and mirrors and the monster. Of course, the monster is obviously made of smoke, and it's holding all these images that are reflections of Echo's life. And so in sort of a nod, dot, wink, wink from the directors or writers, it's saying, hey, here's our smoke and mirrors, you know?
Yeah.
It's mirroring back Echo's stuff, and it's this big thing of smoke. I mean, it is literally a smoke and mirrors.
And you know what I think is a sure thing? It's almost probably a fact that we can bank on. When they go back to the group, like Charlie and Echo, they're not going to talk about it.
No.
Yeah, no.
They're going to be like, hey, dudes, guess what we saw in the woods?
Yeah.
It's crazy.
That's right.
Well, okay, do you think Charlie saw the images?
I don't think so.
He just saw the black
I think he just saw
smoke.
What we saw. I mean, they're kind of, you know, Charlie was up in the tree, and then they gave us that shot looking down.
Yeah.
And another thing they did that they've never done before with the monster is they put the camera from the monster's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Before the monster comes up to him, you have the camera zooming through behind all these trees kind of low to the ground.
Yeah.
And so for the first time, you get a look out of the monster's eyes and see how it moves. And it does move kind of like a swirling sort of...
Yeah.
Deal. My phone just rang, which is why that crazy pause all just happened.
So we're going to move now into kind of one of the last discussions of this episode, which is Michael's conversation with Walt on the computer, or what we're assuming is Walt on the other end.
I'm sorry. I'm going to jump back one more thing. It's a comment from one of the writers who said back when he was talking about, you know, the mysteries that happened on the island. Someone questioned Javier, or Javi, as his name is, whether or not everything would truly have a scientific explanation. He said, I guess it depends on what your threshold of scientific plausibility is. So Murdoch, who wrote this post, is guessing that any explanation we end up getting will be in the realm of highly theoretical science and physics.
So maybe, you know, my speculation that there's something more supernatural, maybe it's just it's a little bit less plausible
science. I mean, once you get to really high theoretical science, as I've got something that's pretty highly theoretical a little later on in this podcast, you'll see it borders on supernatural.
Well, do you want to talk about that now then? Because I think it fits.
I think it fits good after the Michael stuff.
Well, so we obviously have, in this last episode, we have Michael again having another conversation on the computer. In fact, because after that first conversation, I guess it got him so kind of worked up that now we have him wanting to put himself in a place where he can be there on the computer. You know, he takes over Kate's shift or whatever and is down there. And we see him again having this conversation with what he assumes is Walt.
Yeah.
But one of the things that people have a lot of people have brought up, there of course is a lot of speculation. If it is Walt, where is he? How's he talking? Some people have said maybe he's not actually in a hatch, you know, at another computer terminal. Maybe he's, you know, doing something psychically to kind of talk through it. But one of the things that people brought up, and I think it's an interesting discussion, is this whole idea that Michael may be having a hallucination, just like Kate hallucination, just like Jack's hallucination of his dad.
The polar bear.
And the reason they bring that up is because we see when he's talking to Jack, there was, you know, he'd been having this conversation on the computer, and then when we see Jack there and Jack sees it, there's absolutely nothing on the screen.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it brings up like one of two things. Either there's some kind of a screensaver thing on the computer, which a lot of people said at that old of a computer,
not have screen
nothing
savers.
Like that existed. Yeah. And then the other side of it is, well, maybe it's something that only Michael can see, so maybe he's hallucinating or something like that.
Yeah.
But the other thing that brings up is, okay, we thought Kate was hallucinating, but when we saw that episode with the horse, it's pretty clear once Sawyer sees it that the horse is actually there and she touches it and all that stuff. So even if Michael might be hallucinating, there may be some truth behind it.
Yeah, and I think that there's a poster on the fuselage named B.G. McCaw, and he links to this scientific explanation. We'll put a link out on our site. There are three scientists, and this all is in the realm of very highly theoretical science, based on, you know, part aspects of string theory. And you don't have to know a lot about string theory. More, all you need to know is at the subatomic level, things are happening with subatomic particles that scientists cannot explain. Some particles seem to exist simultaneously in two different places, disappear and reappear without any sort of rhyme or reason, and the scientists can't really understand it. But somehow, and this is where they lose me, somehow they're able to go from these mysterious subatomic particles to life really being an illusion. And if you, what was that movie that came out? What the bleep do we know?
Yeah,
it's a documentary that kind of goes in this realm where they find out that our imagination has more control over what is real than we think. And the idea is the universe is a hologram. The scientists are Alan Aspect, David Baum, and Carl Pribram. And I'm just going to read a bit from this summary I had gotten, this link had gone to online. For if the concreteness of the world is but a secondary reality, and what is there is actually a holographic blur of frequencies, and if the brain is also a hologram and only selects some of the frequency out of this blur and mathematically transforms them into sensory perceptions, what becomes of objective reality? Put quite simply, it ceases to exist. As the religions of the East have long upheld, the material world is Maya, an illusion. And although we may think we are physical beings moving through a physical world, this is, too, an illusion. We are really receivers floating through a kaleidoscopic sea of frequency, and what we extract from this sea and transmogrify into physical reality is but one channel from many extracted out of the super hologram. You know, I was transmogrifying this morning.
You said you had me transmogrify.
Yeah.
And I transmogrified some coffee earlier.
In a holographic universe, as Pribram has pointed out, even random events would have to be seen as based on holographic principles and therefore determined. Synchronicities or meaningful coincidences suddenly make sense, and everything in reality would have to be seen as a metaphor, for even the most haphazard events would express some underlying symmetry, which I think is interesting considering the role that coincidence plays in the show. Whether Baum or Pribram's holographic paradigm becomes accepted in science or dies an ignoble death remains to be seen, but it's safe to say that it has already had an influence on the thinking of many scientists, and even if it is found that holographic model does not provide the best explanation for the instantaneous communications that seem to be passing back and forth at the subatomic level. At the very least, the physicist at, this physicist named Basil Haley says it indicates that we must be prepared to consider radical new views of reality. Now, what I like about this idea is what I don't like about it is it makes me think of that movie Sphere, where their imaginations start, materializing real things.
I think we even got an email about that reference.
That reference, yeah. And maybe, like most of Michael Crichton's things, the book is a lot more, positive than a movie.
Well, one of the things that they talk about in the beginning and the kind of the most basic concept of it is sight, the way that our eyes work. Mm-hmm. So the visible spectrum, which is what we know, it's like the rainbow, you see the rainbow of colors. Colors basically are nothing but frequency.
Yeah.
So, when a light wave hits, a red, something that looks red to us, the reason we see it as red is because the frequency that's coming into our eyes shows us that color. Mm-hmm. So there are a number of other waves that aren't within the visible spectrum for a human being. So we can't see things like radio waves, X-rays, things like that.
Yeah.
But the possibility would be, okay, well, what if you could?
Yeah.
What if you could see those things? Yeah. Reality would be totally different.
I think mass is even broken down as a level of frequency in terms of, condensed particles together, how fast they move and all that sort of stuff creates a mass.
So here's the overriding idea then. The idea of Lost is scientifically controlled destiny.
I think the next episode should be called Transmorgify. No, I'm sorry. But I think that when you look at Kate Caesar's horse, it's something that's pulled from her past on this island.
Yeah.
And she tells somebody else about it, and then when she sees it, they're both sharing the same, illusion.
I think he saw it first, didn't he?
Did he see it? Perhaps.
I don't think she mentioned, I had a black horse, or I saw a black horse once when it set me free. He saw it just before she did.
And so it's possible that
he didn't implant that in his brain.
But even so, the idea that people are materializing reality from their imaginations.
Well, I think that it does, it definitely brings up a crazy, possibility of a connection between those things and this smoke monster.
Yeah.
Because if we know the smoke monster has all this stuff from the past, whether it's pulling it out or it already has it, and all the hallucination stuff is from people's past as well.
Yeah. And so, you had mentioned something earlier that you had read on a forum where people were saying that the black horse was actually like smart duster nanobots, the black smoke creating the horse. It wasn't really a horse, but it was like the island had read that, she needed a horse or whatever, so it created a horse out of smoke.
Yeah, and that goes back to the whole Michael Crichton Prey thing.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, we're saying these people are hallucinating, but then there's this real connection, so how could they actually be hallucinating?
Yeah.
Well, maybe they are hallucinating, and then something's being manifested,
I think about 4 hours into it, Hurley would have had himself a big bat cheeseburger.
That's right. That's true.
So let's talk about the mural. We got this link. This link showed up recently, and we've been kind of big on the mural. One of our early podcasts in the second season, when we first saw the mural down in the hatch, Brian put together, kind of photoshopped it together. We did a lot of mural analysis.
Yeah, we got like 4 different shots of the mural and put them together and ran it through a lot of different Photoshop sort of levels and affected the color to see it as clearly as possible, and just kind of left it at that.
And Brian also, a little bit later in the season, we also talked about the connection possibly between Claire's boyfriend who had paintings and how much they looked like stuff in the mural.
If you didn't hear this in one of our last podcasts, Claire's boyfriend from the first season, who impregnates her and then promptly ditches her, is a painter, they have some scenes in his apartment where he's got the same faces and the same fish.
The painting is stylistically, it's almost the same as the mural.
It's freaky. And so there's this link to this huge scrolling page of just tons of images and tons of descriptions of what they're seeing. What's interesting is it says in the lower right-hand portion of the mural, it says it's got a picture of an eye, and then it's got M, and then it says sick. And later on, in another shot in one of the shows, kind of just someone's walking by the mural and they shoot it, that's all scratched out, and it's like the sick part is gone.
Yeah, there's a lot of, it's a web page. We'll put a link up to it on the site.
Some people say it says Dr. M. Sick, Dr. Marvin Candle.
There's a lot of, it's one of, I think, the most comprehensive breakdowns of the mural that I've seen.
Someone spent a lot of time staring at it.
Yeah. So we'll put a link up to that.
Check it out.
One of the other things in terms of this, I guess we're in our Lost Link section now.
Yes.
One of the other things, I got an interesting email from a guy named Tamar. He sent us an email about Hurley actually listening to podcasts. the guy who plays Hurley. What's his name? Hugo? No.
Jorge?
Yeah. So anyway, Tamar says Hurley was on a local radio station here, and they asked him about all the theories people have, and he was talking about how he always listens to Lost podcasts. So he says, anyways, I don't know if you can get a tape of it so you guys can hear what he had to say, but he said the radio station is 101.9 The Mix in Chicago. The website is WTMX.com. I didn't see that they had like archives from the show that you could listen to or anything. But he said it was on, he said it was called the Eric and Kathy Show that's on, at about 7:40 in the morning in Chicago. So
did he mention what podcast he listened to?
No, he just says, he's talking about how he always listens to these podcasts, and Tamar says, I'm assuming he means your podcast, but there are other Lost podcasts out there. So, that'd be interesting. So Hurley, if you're listening,
we love you.
Jorge?
Man, that's killer.
Yeah.
I'll come to this podcast with a whole new energy.
Now, we're going to get into a buzzkill topic here.
We're
going to do some buzzkill.
This is Prince Arwen's post.
Our friend Josh sent us an IM earlier this week. Josh has been on the show a couple times. He's the guy who cooked the boar.
Yeah.
Our Lost once. Watching party. And so he sent us this instant message, and he's like, have you guys seen this? And he sent a link to this post on the Fuselage, and he says, I'm totally through even speculating about the show anymore.
Yeah. And so Prince Arwen had made the original post that Josh had found, and I just took out some excerpts. Lindelof had said, when have we given you a definitive answer to anything? Just sort of going on about how long a ride we've got before we start getting some serious answers. And it goes on, serialized television is a curious thing. The writers control where a story begins, but networks say where it ends. That's especially true with a show that's a hit, whether it's X-Files or Buffy the Vampire Slayer or Lost. Networks want hit shows to stay on as long as possible, even when the original story arc should have long since come to a natural conclusion. The reality is, Lindelof says, that Carlton, myself, J.J. Abrams, the creative brains behind the Lost Universe, we could all band together and say, we're ending the show after three seasons because that's the arc. They get off the island and we reveal the things we want to reveal. And the network would say, no, you won't. Then they'll hire somebody else to do Lost without them. We suggest, and this is continuing Lindelof saying, we suggest you do the same on Lost, Lindelof says, relating it to Alias. That's between the lines. If you're watching the show because you're watching for big answers to come, you have to understand that by the nature of what it is, it's not a movie, it's not a series of movies, it's not a trilogy, it's not a miniseries. It's going to be on the air for as long as ABC wants to keep it on the air, so those answers are going to be off in the distance. How can you ever possibly think that Lost will end? And this is the part that's really sort of a buzzkill, where Lindelof says, how can you ever possibly think that Lost will end in a satisfying way? Carlton and I can almost guarantee you that it will not. In the meantime, the producers strive for a weekly thrill ride that won't disappoint. So far, they succeeded. Since Lost is the first genre series, a catch-all showbiz term for science fiction, fantasy, and horror, to capture a mass audience since The X-Files. It's essentially a cult show in its design and its genre, but what makes it accessible to the wider audience is that it's character-driven. I think that we know, that there are so many different characters, so many different backstories, that they seem to have an endless supply of backstories, as many as they have characters. And also there's characters there for everyone to relate to.
Yeah, and I mean, I get what it is that they're talking about. Like, I get where they say, you know, it's going to be on as long as they want it to. That may not necessarily be the case, though, because I can think of, you know, when Twin Peaks was on, and that was a really popular show, and they literally just did a couple seasons, and it was over with.
Yeah.
But I think that
him
saying that it's not going to end in a satisfying way, I think he's being a little pessimistic. I mean, I think what he was trying to get out there was that it's not going to end in the same way that you have a movie end or something like that, where it's very clear cut. You know.
I think he's basically. I don't know what the context of this, you know, review or these comments come out of, but I wonder if it's a sign of some sort of chafing between, you know, network execs and the producers of the show kind of going on, and him just being sort of down about it. I mean, a lot of great shows get killed by being on too long.
Yeah.
And he's saying this show, because of its success, will be on too long. And as a result, they're not going to be able to sustain the sort of plot arcs that they want to sustain.
He's not saying they're not going to be able to. He said that's normally basically what happens, and we, you know, So it's possible.
Yeah. I mean, X-Files went on for probably 4 years longer than it should have.
One of the things they say at the very beginning of that thing is you have to appreciate the journey and not try to worry about the endpoint. Yeah. So, and I think that the speculation and all the stuff we do every week, I think, is part of that journey.
So, I think so, too. It's fun. I think we'll continue the podcast and continue to, you know, bang our heads against the wall because we enjoy it.
So he's probably in contract negotiations right now, too.
Yeah.
I just wanted to get that out there.
You're probably right.
Well, it's pretty cool because that when I went actually over the break, I watched season one again and watched a lot of the extras. And they talked in there about the show kind of starting. And one of the things that happened was that I guess Lindelof had, like, worked with somebody from ABC on some other pilot. And it didn't happen, like, apparently, but they really liked him. So they said, hey, you gotta meet J.J. Abrams, and he's got this new thing that we're working on. And they got together, and literally it was something where, like, they banged something out really quick, and ABC was like, oh, we love it.
Yeah.
So we're gonna get into, we don't have a spoiler cast from Brian McMillan this week. He's feeling under the weather, so hope Brian feels better. But he'll be back, I'm sure, next week with a spoiler section. We are going to do spoilers, though, so this is the time. We're going to talk about some of the stuff that's happening next time and in some of the future episodes. So if you don't want any spoilers, now is the time to switch off.
We'll see you next week.
And here go the spoilers. So we're going to dig into I'm going to start off with what's happening next time. The next episode, episode 11 of season 2, is called The Hunting Party. And there are a couple different things that are coming out. Here's kind of the summary that's coming. I think it was from ABC's official, like, media press release thing. The description of the story is Jack Locke and Sawyer pursue a determined Michael after he heads into the jungle toward the dreaded others in search of Walt. Meanwhile, Sun has a surprising reaction to Jen's desire to join the search party. And Hurley and Charlie commiserate over the age-old conundrum of what women want. Now, we have, from some other sources, people have said that Hurley apparently has developed a crush on Libby. And one of the future episodes, I think, is going to have a lot more about it. I don't think it's going to be this next one. But I think that's probably what the whole Hurley and Charlie commiserating over what women want.
And a spoiler I have about Libby is apparently Libby will come to the fore in future episodes. She's a little bit of a stealth surprise. And this is a quote from the producers. She's a little bit of a stealth surprise that we have cooking on the island, Lindelof says. That is going to be very cool when the longer game reveals itself. No doubt Libby's revelations will answer a few questions, but also add the ever-growing list of inexplicable things on the island, which includes unseen monsters, polar bears, yada, yada, yada. I think I know exactly what Libby's backstory is, and I've told you guys this earlier this week.
Oh, yeah.
I think she has a very conflict-oriented family issues.
Really?
Yes.
Really?
I think, yes.
She does?
And I'm pretty sure she's missing one parent.
Huh. I bet.
Just throwing that out there, everybody. Huh. I said
you think
first,
she killed anybody?
There might be a parental issue.
I think there's probably some serious moral dilemmas in her past.
Now, it is interesting that Hurley...
And that somebody else on the island is going to have a really interesting connection to her.
Yes.
That's a good thing you gave it. Spoiler alert.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
we've already...
want to know that.
Yeah. We've already talked about, you know... Well, one thing that's interesting is that Hurley would have a crush on her because she's a psychologist and he's been in a psych ward. But
the connections are starting already.
But the other thing, too, is you remember we had brought up a while back that we thought Libby might be connected to the guy that Sun was set up with who said he was leaving to go to America. And
she might have been the wife, like the guy who was originally going to marry Jen.
Yeah.
Or marry Sun.
Marry Sun, yeah. And he was like, I'm leaving to go to the U.S. as a woman. And
The Korean Kojak. He was.
So here's another thing. There are a couple other spoiler things that we have. So they say, let's see here. We'll get closer to an answer. Someone makes a chilling return in the January 18th episode. And on January 18th, we'll also finally learn some of the problems that plagued Jack's marriage to Sarah and why that's bad news for any romance with Kate. Apparently, the focus of the flashbacks in this next episode, The Hunting Party, are going to be Jack-specific, related to his marriage.
Oh, cool. So does that make it Desmond? Who else has a connection to Jack's wife?
I don't know.
He kind of...
We may find out. or maybe Sawyer has a connection to Jack Black.
Sweet.
Oh, damn.
The other thing, too, that I would bring up, and this was something that was brought up a long time ago. You may remember that some people had talked about this Italian couple that was supposed to make debut. Originally, this next episode was supposed to be the episode that happened in. I thought I remember hearing something that wasn't going to happen. That it was something that they had brought up, but it got shot down or something. They decided not to carry through with it. So I don't know. It's possible that could happen in the next show. Yeah. So there's some interesting stuff going on.
What do you think is going to happen
in the next one?
Yeah. What about your theories?
Well, I don't know. I think that I still think that, you know, I have hope still for the whole Montauk Philadelphia experiment stuff. It's still in there in my brain and part of this whole manifesting things out of your mind.
Yeah, but next episode.
Yeah, next episode. I don't want to get big.
I don't know.
I
think that all the stuff with I don't think that Jack's marriage issues are really going to have any type of effect on the plot whatsoever. I think that next episode we're going to be really disappointed with the flashbacks because we're not going to learn anything at all. It's just going to be setting up more drama with Kate and all that stuff. So. And I imagine that may even play a prominent role in the next episode with more kind of Jack Sawyer Kate awkwardness.
Yeah. I think we've been, I mean, if you're asking me that question, yeah. I would say that call the hunting party. I think we're going to get ready for another, you know, three or four episodes like we did last season or the first half of the season where we have a group of them that are developing a whole new plot line away from the camp. Away from the main fuselage campers area. And so we're going to break off and we're once again going to have two different stories going on where we'll focus on these guys for a while and then focus on these guys for a while. And also, I know Desmond's coming back at some point, what I hear. And so I wonder if we're launching a plot arc here with Hunting Party that's going to resolve with another meeting with Desmond.
You know, the other thing that brings up is, you know, they say that Sun's going to have a surprising reaction to Jen's wanting to join the hunting party. My guess is that her surprising reaction is going to be, okay, sure. But that brings up the whole issue is, man, it seems kind of weird to me. And, you know, I was thinking before about how there may be some weird connections with Jen maybe being involved somehow or the Korean connection to the Dharma Initiative. Why is it that Jen has to volunteer for everything? He's like all over the place.
Yeah.
It's like he always wants to be there if they find anything.
Yeah, I think another read into that idea of surprising or that word surprising is that she has been so submissive to whatever he wants to do is that now she may stand up for herself. She's gained enough independence on the island to say, no, you're not going. You've already had your fun. You've got to run around with the boys. It's time to, you know, develop.
She's going to throw him in a pit.
Well, maybe she goes. Maybe she goes with him.
That's true.
Maybe that too.
Well,
all right, guys,
we'll be back next week, and I'm sure we've got a lot of stuff to talk about. And remember that the official Lost podcast comes out on Mondays, so tomorrow there'll be a new official Lost podcast episode that'll inform.
Yep, and Hurley, if you're out there listening to the podcast,
give us a call, man.
Give us a call.
Just say, that'd be awesome.
Just say, hey, you know, I'm listening.
All right. You can say more of that.
She certainly can't talk about anything. So just say what's up. All right.
Stay lost,
everybody.
Stay lost.